Hello, I'm Jane Krauser, Editor-in-Chief of Total Film. Welcome to Total Film's Last Picture Show. The elevator pitch, it's the end of the world and you have one last night at the cinema. What four films are you programming and why? Our guest today is well known to Total Film readers as the magazine's trusty news editor and a regular contributor to the Inside Total Film podcast. He's a journalism graduate from Cardiff University and made his start in print on SFX magazine before arriving at Total Film Towers in 2016. He's now the team's Cannes correspondent, alien franchise nerd, James Cameron superfan, and our resident tech troubleshooter. He's Jordan Farley. Welcome to the Last Picture Show, Jordan.
Hi.
How does it feel being on the other side of this? Like, you're usually doing it to someone else.
Yeah, extremely bizarre. I'm just sort of reiterating what Matt Maytham said on his Last Picture Show podcast, but I don't think I've ever been in a situation where I've been the one who's being interviewed. Usually it's me who's throwing the questions that direction.
Yes.
They're coming the wrong way.
Yes, well, be honest. Use it as therapy. Mm-hmm. Let's start with an easy one. What's the first film you ever saw in the cinema?
So I'm pretty sure it was Beauty and the Beast. Classic Disney animation. Came out in 1991. I was 5 years old, but I still have a very distinct memory of watching it at a tiny cinema in Clitheroe, which is a small town near where I grew up in Burnley in Lancashire. I went with my mum, and I have a very distinct recollection of bawling my eyes out at the end when the beast turns back into the prince. Just affected me very, very deeply. I think it unlocks something because I'm a big weeper in films, and I think it all goes back to that moment, basically, where my emotions were unleashed.
Yes.
But yeah, beautiful film.
Yeah. And what did you think about the experience of being in a cinema with other people? You obviously probably had watched stuff at home on your VHS, but this was like this communal experience.
Yeah, it was mind-blowing to me, even at such a young age. The cinema I went to, a very small cinema, like probably about 30 seats in the whole thing, but I still remember just being completely overwhelmed by it, thinking it was one of the great experiences of my young life at that time. We sat in the very front row, and obviously I was tiny, so I was sort of craning my neck up to just be able to see the screen, and it just overwhelmed me. And I even kind of remember the smell. Just, I don't know if my memories of cinema smells since have infiltrated that memory, but I feel like I have a very clear sense memory of what it was even like to smell the popcorn and the sticky seats and all that kind of stuff from that one cinema experience, which is very odd because I don't remember many other experiences of going to the cinema quite young, but that one's just so clear in my mind.
Did you then think, right, I want to go to the cinema every week, I'm a cinephile now? Or when did that sort of love of film come along for you?
Yeah, actually, not really. My great love when I was young was video games, actually. I used to obsessively read a magazine called N64 Magazine, which was published by our company, Future Publishing. So when I started working at Future, I actually got to meet a lot of the journalists who worked on that magazine I loved when I was young. So I still enjoyed films as a young man growing up, but it wasn't my first passion in the way that it sort of is now. It really kicked in when DVDs started coming out, I think. That really sort of democratized access to cinema more generally at that time, because VHSs were just so expensive when I was younger. I remember I used to have, I think it was 6 Bond films on VHS. They were just on hard rotation throughout my entire childhood. And I just hadn't seen any other Bond films apart from those 6 films.
What were the 6? So what are your hardcore Bonds? Yeah.
So Goldfinger, Diamonds Are Forever was one of them.
Very,
I know,
good.
Not generally considered one of the best, but I absolutely love it because of that. GoldenEye is one of them. Tomorrow Never Dies. Honor Majesty's Secret Service. Live and Let Die was the last one. So I didn't even have any Timothy Dalton Bonds.
Yeah,
like, I was missing out on like whole eras of Bonds. I only had one Roger Moore Bond. Oh, no, sorry. I had The Man with the Golden Gun as well. So that would be 7. So I had these 7, but you know, beyond that, I didn't have a huge amount of films on VHS. I would generally just record films off the TV that I wanted to watch. Yeah, it was really when the DVD era properly kicked in that I became really obsessed with films. I was able to see things that just weren't readily available at that point before. And you had the whole aspect where because of director's commentaries and behind-the-scenes featurettes, bonus features, I got a real insight into making films, which I just didn't have until that point. Really, you could only learn about that stuff if you were reading magazines or you were reading books. And I was more interested in fiction at that point in my life. I wasn't reading non-fiction things about the making of films. I became just obsessed with buying DVDs, basically. My parents very generously enabled this addiction and would buy me most things that I wanted if I asked nicely and was well behaved. So I ended up having like a huge collection of DVDs, and every day I would sit down and watch like two or three films. At that time, because I wasn't working, I was sort of in school, but I didn't have any real extracurricular commitments beyond homework. So I would just watch every single bonus feature on every single DVD I got. Every Christmas I'd get like the Lord of the Rings DVDs, and I would watch, you know, hours and hours of special features. I would listen to like all the commentaries on them. There's like four or five commentaries on each of those DVDs. That was where the obsession really kicked in, where I was like, okay, this is what I really love and what I would think I would love to do with the rest of my life.
Where did the sort of guidance come for what you would choose next? Where did you look to? Were you sort of reading any sort of criticism books, or were you reading magazines? When did that sort of the guidance of what you should be watching next come from?
At that time, I did start reading magazines. I started reading Total Film and other magazines. And a lot of it just came from what was out. I would just go and watch. At that time, they started introducing the monthly passes where you could just go and watch as much as you want, and I would just go and see absolutely everything. Like, even if I knew it was going to be bad, I'd go and watch it. I have a very distinct memory of going to see The Spirit, the Frank Miller film, one Friday night, literally just me in a cinema in Cardiff, just because I was completist in that way. I just had to see absolutely everything. It got to the point where I was just, it was probably unhealthy, to be honest, where I was just trying to see absolutely everything. So it was really, I could have done with some curation and some guidance at that time in my life.
Yeah,
I think.
Don't go and see The Spirit.
Yeah, exactly. I was just going to see everything, which sort of worked out well, because there's a period of time where I've just seen absolutely everything. Like, there's very little that I haven't seen from the years in between that period, which is kind of mad to me now, even when I think I'm doing this job professionally, and even now I can't keep up with everything. But there's a time where, yeah, so that era of film is like my mastermind subject, basically, where I could just tell you anything about everything, basically.
And when did you realize that you could sort of parlay that into a job?
Not till quite late, to be honest, because I went down a very sort of boring academic route for a degree. I'd studied history just because I enjoyed the subject, with no real thought to what that would lead to or what it might help me achieve in terms of career goals. But while I was at uni, I started writing for the student paper, and I started writing film reviews for the student paper because I saw everything. I had a friend who was basically the editor of the entertainment or arts section in one of the student papers. And he knew that I had seen a film that he needed a review of. And he was like, can you do it? And I did. And it was David Fincher's Zodiac. And that was my first ever review printed in a student paper. And I think that was probably the moment where I thought, oh, I'm enjoying this so much. I would love to do this, because I did have a slightly tough time at university, in the sense that I probably worked too hard. Like, I just burnt out, basically. There was a lot of reading required on my course, and I just got to the point where I just got quite fed up of reading history books, as much as I previously enjoyed the subject. And just having a different outlet for my creativity just really seemed to just unlock something in my brain. I just thought, oh yeah, this is what I need to do, basically. But I don't think I really realized that until very late into the second year, if not the start of the third year of my degree. So even then, I was still very focused on just finishing my degree. And it wasn't really until I finished uni that I thought, how do I get a job doing that? And that's when I sort of pursued that.
Well, we'll talk about that and how you got to where you are now. But first, let's talk about your first film that you're going to put on this program. What is it?
It's 1986's Aliens.
Talk to me, Hudson.
I got signals. I got readings in front and behind.
There's nothing back here.
Look, I'm telling you, there's something moving and it ain't us.
Get them out of there.
There's movement all over the place.
5 meters, man. 4.
So Aliens. Now, I know that you're a massive fan because I work with you every day, but what is it about this film and why this particular film within this franchise?
It's partly the classic thing in that I saw it quite young and it imprinted on my brain. I saw it when I was about 12 or 13, obviously far too young to see a film like this. It's 18 rated. We just got Sky and it was shown as part of some movie season. I think it was called the Lillette's Leading Ladies season, like feminine hygiene product season, where it was all about leading ladies in films. I have a very clear memory of it because you would have like the eye dent in every ad break.
Not the best way to see a film.
No, absolutely not. But when you're that age and all you've known is VHS and Sky, you put up with it. You put up with it. But yeah, I was immediately taken by it, just completely blown away. I had obviously not seen anything like that at that point in my life. James Cameron's just an absolute master storyteller, an absolute master filmmaker. I had no idea at the time that Aliens is one of the greatest sequels ever made. I mean, in my opinion, it's the greatest film ever made. Certainly my favorite film ever made. It's just an absolute masterclass in action filmmaking, in tension. I think Ripley's one of the great film characters, full stop. Not just one of the great leading ladies. Sigourney Weaver was obviously Oscar nominated for her performance in that film, which says a lot given the Academy's bias towards genre pictures at that time. There's so much depth to it. I've always loved Cameron's style of filmmaking. I'm so in tune with his obsessions, his science fiction obsessions, his military obsessions, his environmental obsessions. All those kind of things are things that really speak to me. And it all just came together in this. And as you'll learn over the course of this podcast, I'm very much into dark, kind of nihilistic, apocalyptic films.
Yes.
And Alien certainly has that aspect in the sense that all these Marines who go to LV-426, they've got no hope there. They're so outclassed. Even though they've got the technological advantage, they're very much not on home turf and they're just immediately overwhelmed. And I love when the movie just turns into a kind of run and gun movie where they're just trying to escape at that point. You think it's going to be an absolute pushover for them, but it's absolutely not.
Is that sort of leaning into your gaming sensibilities as well with that gunning and running business that
a little bit sort of taps into
that side of your interest?
Definitely, yeah. Aliens is such a huge influence on the gaming industry. You know, the pulse rifle has transitioned into many games, most famously Halo. And I think a lot of games developers are very open about the fact that Aliens was one of the biggest influences certainly on the first-person shooter genre. So there's definitely that overlap as well. The interesting thing about me loving Aliens so much is that at that age is that I hadn't seen Alien when I first saw Aliens. And it kind of blows my mind a little bit because those two films work so well together, despite the fact they're made by completely different creative teams, essentially. It works so well as a standalone film, evidenced by the fact that I saw it at that age, had no idea Alien even existed because it's not called Alien 2.
Yeah.
I think I just had no idea. I thought it's just called Aliens, like it's just a standalone film called Aliens. It just does so many interesting things that build on the things that have come before, but also work completely in and of themselves. And that's sort of the definition of what a great sequel should be. It should work by itself if it needs to, but if you've seen the original, then it enhances it in so many different ways.
And when did you finally get to see it on a big screen?
I saw it at the first time on a big screen at the Printworks in Manchester. When I was about 18, I must have been 18 because they wouldn't have let me in otherwise.
So that
would have been around the early 2000s, basically. I can't remember the exact year, but it's a film I've actually seen on the big screen only a couple of times. There was that Printworks experience, and then I saw it a second time at the Royal Albert Hall when they did a live orchestral version of the score, which they played, which James Cameron and Gaylan Hurd and Sigourney Weaver were all in attendance. Genuinely one of the great cinematic experiences of my life. I couldn't quite believe it because I'm a huge fan of James Horner's score in that film as well. It's very familiar if you've seen The Wrath of Khan. He definitely had some motifs that he carried throughout all his work, but I just think it's an absolute masterclass in propulsive, explosive score making. It's an incredible piece of work.
And speaking of Sigourney, you have had some of your little dreams come true, haven't you?
I have met
the great Sigourney Weaver and been on a Bond set. What do you think that kid that was watching those VHSs would think if they could see you now and the things that you're doing now in your job?
mind would probably be blown. Yeah, being on the 007 stage at Pinewood was particularly surreal, because you can just feel the history there. Like, you can just feel these are the corridors that Sean Connery and Roger Moore and Timothy Dalton and George Lazenby and Pierce Brosnan all walk down, and oh, Daniel Craig's over there filming the scene. I was on the set of No Time to Die, and I saw the scene in Jamaica where he's in the nightclub with Felix Leiter, so I saw that scene being filmed. I was also on set in Scotland for that film as well, for an actual car chase, which is really cool to see, like, a Bond action scene come together. Yeah, it's hard to fathom what young me would really think. Like, I'm not sure I even processed the fact that people actually made films at the age when I was fully obsessed with Bond. Like, I think it was only later that I'd sort of got my head around the fact that, you know, these are made by armies of people, and especially the fact that Bond is really made by a very consistent through line of creatives who work across multiple films, and there's a real sort of family feel to that creative team. Just being able to just observe that really just felt like, yeah, being a small part of a much grander history.
Hmm. What other amazing things have you managed to do as a film journalist?
I mean, you mentioned Sigourney Weaver there. Yeah. So I've interviewed her twice now, once in person. Wasn't for Aliens, unfortunately, it was for A Monster Calls. But it's the only time in my entire career where I've asked someone I've been interviewing to sign something for me, which is a little bit of a no-no. When you're interviewing people, you're not really supposed to ask for personal things like that. But I just couldn't resist. I had to do it. I had my Alien Anthology Blu-ray set, so I've got to sign that. Lovely Sigourney signature on the front of that now. Generally, the people that I'm most excited to interview are filmmakers. I've interviewed Ridley Scott. I'm also a huge fan of Alien, I should say. I think,
yes,
similarly a masterpiece, just very different from Aliens. It's almost like apples and oranges comparing them. Sometimes I find it hard to choose between which is the quote-unquote greater of the two, but Aliens has always edged it out for me because I loved it from a very early age. I interviewed Ridley Scott on the set of Alien Covenant in Australia, in Sydney. And despite the fact that film didn't turn out to be one of his greatest works at the time, it was mind-blowing to me, because there was Ridley Scott. There was a guy in an alien suit. It was like, yeah, I just...
A pinch me moment.
Yeah, I just couldn't quite believe what was happening. And Ridley was awesome. I love speaking to Ridley Scott. I've interviewed him a few times now, and he's always great. He's got one of the great curious minds, I think. Like, he becomes obsessed with subjects, and you can just feel how he just wants to talk about them. Like, on Covenant, he was just obsessed with the idea of artificial intelligence and what the future of humanity is going to be, which is going to tie into one of my other choices very soon. And he was obsessed with space travel and what that could mean for the future of humanity and all these kind of things. And you're just like, yeah, this is why you're one of the greats. Like, you're endlessly curious, and you've always got interest things on your mind that are interesting you. But yeah, just a lot of great fun set visits. I also did Thor Ragnarok on the Gold Coast, also in Australia. That was a lot of fun, interviewing Tom Hiddleston and Cate Blanchett and Chris Hemsworth and Tessa Thompson in costume.
Yeah, with the headdress on.
Yeah, watching Taika Waititi, like, sleep on set, all that kind of stuff. Marvel sets are very odd because just a lot of it's not there. Like, a lot of, you see, like, snippets of sets that they built, and then just a lot of green screen in big sound stages, so you really have to use your imagination to think, what is it going to be like? And then when you see those scenes in the film, you're like, oh yeah, I could never have pictured how great this was going to look just based on how ramshackle it looked when I was on set. Those are always the most bizarre experiences. But Covenant was almost the exact opposite of that, where the set was just there, which was incredible, and I guess a testament to what Ridley does. He just builds worlds.
He does build worlds. Speaking of that, we should probably move on to your next choice. Mm-hmm. What are you programming next?
Yeah, it's Ridley Scott's Blade Runner.
There was an escape from the off-world colonies 2 weeks ago. 6 replicants, 3 male, 3 female. They slaughtered 20.
A Blade Runner's job is to hunt down replicants, manufactured humans you can't tell from the real thing.
What's this?
Roy Batty, probably the leader.
There was just one outfit making replicants that superhuman. The Terrell Corporation.
Mr. Deckard, Dr. Eldon Terrell.
I don't get it, Tyrell.
Commerce is our goal here at Tyrell. More human than human is our motto.
I was looking for 6 replicants. in a city of 106 million people.
You ever see this girl, huh?
Never seen her, Buzzlove.
What I didn't know was they were looking for me.
Ridley Scott's Blade Runner, another dark sort of, oh my God, how are we going to get through this film? Tell us where you saw this first and why you're going to program this.
Yeah, I should be upfront. It's a bit of a tough night viewing if you're in for my last picture show. Like, it's not very cheery. But throughout my whole life, I've actually gravitated towards darker films when I've been in darker places. Like, I tend not to watch comedies and feel-good films when I'm feeling a bit down. I tend to gravitate towards more nihilistic things, and they tend to make me feel better. I don't know what that says about me. Maybe it's just Schadenfreude thing, where I just think I want to see other people suffering, yeah, and it'll make me feel better about my suffering.
Or at least I'm not a replicant.
Yeah,
you know, my life could be worse.
Exactly. It could be worse. But yeah, Blade Runner's on the list because I think it's just the ultimate example of big screen sci-fi world building. Every time I watch it, it blows my mind to this day that it was made in 1982 when CGI didn't exist. Like, I have no idea how they achieved some of the things that they did in that film. The miniatures look absolutely incredible, bigatures, whatever you want to call them. And then married to that is the fact that you have this incredibly deep and intriguing story about what is humanity, what is the difference between artificial life and organic life, is there a difference? There's just so much going on under the surface in Blade Runner. You have such complex characters, which ironically the most complex characters are the ones that aren't human, essentially. And the human characters are sometimes quite shallow, which I actually think is an intentional choice. I think there's a good reason why Rory Batty is the deepest character in that film, and he's the one closest to death, and he's the one that you learn the most about humanity through. I just love all that side of it. It really spoke to me at a time when I was at my intellectually wankiest, I would say, when I wanted to understand the world and philosophy and try to expand my horizons a little bit. Like, Blade Runner was that film that really spoke to me, in the sense that it felt like it was challenging me on an intellectual level in a way that a lot of films just don't even bother to, let alone achieve successfully.
What's your favourite scene in that film? You mentioned Roy Batty. That often, the sort of tears in the rain scene is one that people often mention as a favourite. Mm-hmm. Is that, you know, very special to you, or is there something else in that film that really speaks to you?
Yeah, the tears in rain speech is an absolute classic. It's hard to top that scene. Sort of mind-blowing to me that Rutger Hauer was the person largely responsible for making that speech so elegant. A lot of the words were already there, but he's the one who really refined it, and he was the one who introduced all these moments will be lost in time, like tears and rain. That all came from him. It makes it so beautiful, so meaningful. It's hard for me to pick out a favorite scene from all of my favorite films, to be honest, just because I love them all just so completely. I don't think there's a scene I don't like in most of them. But I particularly love just the opening shot of Blade Runner. You know, the eye opening, and then the view over 2019 LA with the burning towers and the smoke billowing up. Just absolutely beautiful. And this is such a great scene setting shot. Like, you really just know what you're in for with that Vangelis score playing over the top, the tinkles of the piano and all that kind of stuff. Just really, really beautiful. And then I think it's got one of the great endings in film history as well.
Do you like an ambiguous ending?
Love an ambiguous ending. I'm all about ambiguous endings. I should say we're talking about the director's cut and the final cut in this case, theatrical cut.
We should probably talk about that. Yeah. Like, which is your preferred? Mm-hmm.
If I was going to watch it now, I would go for the final cut, probably, or the director's cut. The final cut's just basically a cleaned up version of the director's cut. It's got a couple of extra scenes, the unicorn scene being the main one. A lot of people have a bugbear about the unicorn scene because they think it hammers home the ambiguity too much. Like, it says definitively that Deckard is a replicant, but I don't mind that so much because in my head, Deckard is definitely a replicant. It makes it a much richer film if Deckard is a replicant. He's hunting his own kind. He's unaware about his own artificiality, and his relationship with Rachel is heightened because of all that. I think that's also great. But yeah, final cut and director's cut is what I would go for. It's interesting that three of the films that I'm going to talk about all have famous alternate versions.
Exactly.
Aliens has one, of course, the special edition version, which again is one that is often debated because people say, oh, the special edition ruins the tension of the theatrical cut, where it shows you glimpses of the colonizers on LV-426 before they land. So you know that the aliens are going to be there. There's no mystery about what's happened to them. But you know that after the first time you watch it, so it doesn't matter. But I really like it, seeing the colonizers on that planet. I love seeing you going up to the derelict with her family, and you get the awesome turret sequence, which is one of the other major additions, which another big video game influence. Yes. You see turrets in games everywhere. But yeah, I'm generally for the director's cut or the expanded editions or the final cuts in the case of Blade Runner, with the exception of one film coming up, which we'll discuss when we get to that.
Yes. But,
and it's important as well that the directors have input into what these alternate cuts are going to be. Like, if it's director approved, it's sometimes hard to argue with the fact that this is a definitive version of this film.
You said earlier that you're a crier, you enjoy a cry. Does Blade Runner make you cry? Does it still have the power to bring a tear to your eye?
Yeah, a little bit. It doesn't make me break out in floods, you know, but I still get very emotional at Roy Batty at the end, especially. It's the fact that he, like, saves Deckard at the end. Every time it gets me. He can just let him fall. He can let him die. But A, I think he knows he's one of his kind, so he saves him partly because of that. And B, it's because he's got past his need for revenge at that point. Like, he's facing his own mortality. He's happy to let that go at that point. Like, he just wants to be in that moment with someone, I think, as the rain's falling around him with his memories.
I've seen things you people wouldn't believe. Attack ships on fire off the shoulder of Orion. I watched sea beams glitter in the dark near the Tannhauser Gate. All those moments will be lost in time, like tears in rain. Time to die.
Yeah, I find that incredibly moving, which is really surprising, because it's such a hard-edged film. Like, it's real hard sci-fi in a way. It created the cyberpunk genre. It's not playing on your emotions in a sentimental way. It just does it quite honestly, which I think is very commendable.
Mm. Do you think you use film as a sort of therapy?
A little bit, if it's not like too dark to say. Like, I have a difficult time crying with very personal bereavements. Like, when I have losses, I find it very difficult to experience intense emotions around those. I tend to just process them quite, don't know, internally. I have very little outward showing of emotion, certainly in previous experiences in my life. Fortunately, I haven't had many experiences with bereavement. But with films, I find that almost anything can set me off to, like, almost an embarrassing degree. One of my most famously embarrassing examples, which I often tell people, is that I watched Secret Life of Pets on a plane and just couldn't control the floods of tears at the end when one of the dogs is, like, almost drowning in the van at the end. I just couldn't contain myself.
Had you had a glass of wine, Jordan, with your meal?
I don't drink on planes, so okay. It definitely wasn't that.
But altitude does apparently affect your emotions.
Altitude so does definitely.
You can use that as an excuse, but you're basically blubbing in your seat, are you?
100%, like, constantly. I should also point out that I'm a real sucker for, like, sad dog movies as well, because I'm a dog owner.
Am I allowed to say Archie?
Please don't, or otherwise I'll break out in floods of tears right now.
Or Marley and Me.
Oh, God. Marley and Me less so, because I feel that's quite manipulative and quite cynical. But, oh, my God, if you haven't seen Hashi, A Dog's Tale, oh, my God, it's brutal. Probably the most brutal film ever made. It honestly, I had to write about it for a feature we did in the magazine about 6 months ago. And I started crying while I was writing it. Not because my writing's so terrible, but because just the memories of this particular moment in Hashi, A Dog's Tale just destroyed me. It's just horrible. It's absolutely horrible. But it's a wonderful film.
Yes.
It's just really hard for me to watch as a dog lover.
Yeah, you can only watch it once.
Exactly.
So let's talk about your next film that you're going to put on your program. Also completely bleak and wonderful, it is
The Thing.
Twelve men have just discovered something. For 100,000 years, it was buried in the snow and ice. Now it has found a place to live. Inside, where no one can see it or hear it, or feel it.
I know I'm human. Some of you are still human. This thing doesn't want to show itself. It wants to hide inside an imitation. It'll fight if it has to, but it's vulnerable out in the open. If it takes us over, then it has no more enemies. Nobody left to kill it. And then it's one.
You guys gonna listen to Gary? He can beat one of those things!
So this is the thing. This is the John Carpenter thing.
Yes, 100%, yep.
Tell us why this needs to be seen on a big screen.
It's a masterpiece, for starters. It's John Carpenter's best film, I think. He's made a number of masterpieces. I think this one is a nose ahead of Halloween and several others. It's his definitely his bleakest film, possibly one of the bleakest films ever made, depending on how you read yet another ambiguous ending. I think it's one of the great examples of creature effects in films. As you can probably tell from my list so far, I'm a huge sci-fi fan. It's definitely my genre of choice. And this is sort of the ultimate example for me of creature and alien movies. It's wild to me that this came out not only at the same time as Blade Runner, the same summer as Blade Runner, but it came out in the same year as E.T., which is the, you know, the other great alien movie. The Thing famously flopped because this was the summer of E.T. This was the year that people wanted to see the lovely,
the cute
cuddly
one.
Alien. Yeah, exactly. The Thing was absolutely eviscerated by critics, dead on arrival at the box office. But it's one of the, it's probably one of the few films which has just done a complete 180 in the years since. It's totally been critically reevaluated. I think if you're a film fan, I think it's impossible not to take The Thing incredibly seriously as a great work of art. The fact that it's a great work of just claustrophobic paranoia as well. I love that side of it. The interplay between the men, the Antarctic setting, the Ennio Morricone score. It all just works together so beautifully. And John Carpenter was on a real run at that time. He'd already made Halloween at that point. He'd made The Fog, which was perhaps less successful, but it was a great example of, you know, the ghost story on screen. But The Thing is where he's at his creative peak, basically. It's his apex mountain. And I don't think any filmmaker has reached that level, certainly not in that very specific sci-fi horror subgenre. Like, it's just as good as it gets for me. I've actually probably seen The Thing more than any other film on this list. I'm not entirely sure why, but it's one that I can happily just return to at any time because I just find so much to enjoy in it. And there's a great dog in it.
There is a great dog. A very nice dog by the end of it.
No.
It's famous for all of its jump scares and moments of sort of...
Yeah, body horror.
What's your favourite?
I mean, it's hard not to go with the blood test scene. Again, a great example of tension building. Carpenter, Cameron, these were great filmmakers who knew how to play an audience. They knew when to hold back, when to finally deliver. The blood test scene is incredible, every moment of it. The sound design, the needle touching the bottom. Horrible. And then when the thing is eventually outed, just every kind of shake, every shiver, the ropes kind of flying off, like everything is just sort of burnt into my memory. It's just so terrifying, just really thinking about how I would react in those moments as well. Absolutely horrible. But again, it's so hard for me to just pick a single favorite moment from these films because I could just list off like 10. The autopsy scene is absolutely remarkable. The head coming off.
Oh, the spider head.
Just
trotting off down there.
Yeah. The
and the humor in this film as well. That's what also makes it so great. It's like this horrific thing's happening, but there is still humor in some of these exchanges.
Yeah. Blade Runner is a more serious film. The Thing and Aliens are both very funny films, I think. They have funny characters. They undercut their tension with humor, which is, they just use it. Cameron and Carpenter just use humor as a weapon. It's just another element in their toolkit that they can use to create a better film. And they just know how to use all these elements in complete harmony. Yeah, the thing is so, so great. I could watch it endlessly.
And you've met John Carpenter?
I have.
How was that?
Unfortunately, not in person. I interviewed him over the phone for Halloween Kills not too long ago, last year. He was tremendous. I was in the very lucky position that I got to basically have a career chat with him. So I got to ask him about anything across his career. He's very much a no-nonsense kind of guy, I would say, at this time in his life. He's obviously had a bit of a tumultuous career. I think he was done dirty by the studios, certainly towards the late 80s in his career. He found it very difficult to get the films he wanted to make made. That instilled a deep distrust in the studio system in him, I think. It's something that he's never quite got over in a way, I think, which I do find a little bit sad, because I would love to see another John Carpenter film. Obviously, his 90s output probably doesn't really compare to what he was doing with the 80s, but I still love a lot of what he was doing. Prince of Darkness especially is a great film. I would love if he just came back and made another film. Don't think it's going to happen. I think he's much happier sitting at home playing video games.
Yeah, and writing music with his son.
Writing music, yeah. I think music has become his new passion, which has worked out well, because I think his Halloween scores are absolutely tremendous. Like, I think more people should be hiring him to score their horror films. But yeah, he's a great guy to talk to. He's very gracious, but he's also very clear about the fact that he doesn't look back on this time with rose-tinted glasses, I would say. Like, he just tells you as it is, and that is actually quite refreshing. Like, he's not trying to paper over the cracks. He's just going, yeah, it was absolutely terrible shooting Big Trouble in Little China. Like, I hated a lot of what I had to deal with on that film, but he had a great time with Kurt Russell. He loved martial arts films. He got to make his own movie in that genre. Like, that's incredible, and it's great to hear him talk about the things that he's passionate about, because he does sort of come alive in those moments.
Speaking of talking to people, you obviously talk to filmmakers, actors, mm-hmm. actresses, production designers all day long. This mm-hmm. is your bread and butter. Does it still excite you? And what about the industry keeps you still excited about it?
My day-to-day job on Talk Film Magazine is that I'm the news editor, and that primarily involves speaking to filmmakers, whether that be directors, actors, or other filmmaking disciplines. And that's really the thing I'm still sort of most passionate about, is picking filmmakers' brains, saying, why did you do this? What did you want to achieve with this? Why did you make this choice? And they almost always have fascinating answers to throw back at you, because they're people who have thought about these questions for years in the making of these films. And there's almost always a good reason behind everything, often that you haven't thought of. And it can really enrich your appreciation of a film when you hear where a filmmaker is coming from. I've certainly had experiences where I've watched films and been a little bit baffled by them and not really sure what to make of them, or what the filmmaker was even hoping to do with their films. But then I've spoken to them, and it sort of really cleared things up for me in a way that I feel incredibly grateful for, because that's not the experience most people will have, of course. Like, all that most people have is they go off the film and that's it. But that's really what I try to do as part of my day-to-day job, is sort of enrich your enjoyment of a film by saying, this is what the thinking behind this film is, which can really, it can really expand what you think about a film.
You obviously met a lot of your heroes. Who have you got left on your list that you really need to speak to before this end of the world program starts?
Yeah, I'm in a very lucky position where I've spoken to the directors of my three favorite films, which are the ones I really want to speak to. I've spoken to Sigourney Weaver, who is the star of my favorite film. So that's all done, but there are so many. Unfortunately, I never got the chance to interview Bill Paxton, very sadly, who is my other favorite character from Aliens, Hudson. Just an absolute firecracker of a personality from everything I ever heard. So that was a real shame. But I've never done Kurt Russell. I'd love to do Kurt Russell at some point. I would love to do Kurt Russell and John Carpenter at the same time, because going back to my previous DVD experience, some of my favorite director's commentaries were the John Carpenter, Kurt Russell ones. And they're so much fun together. I think they would be great to get together in a room to talk about their collaborations together, which they have done ad nauseum, but, you know, they're old pals. They can they can reminisce again one more time.
I'm sure they could, yeah.
Yeah.
What's the best thing about your job, and what's the worst thing about your job?
Yeah, the best thing is speaking to people, definitely. It's just something you just don't get to do in any other line of work in the same way. You know, even people who work on films don't get the chance to sit down with a director for 15, 20, 30 minutes, an hour, just to pick their brains on a film. That's just exceedingly rare. It really only comes from our profession. So I feel very privileged to be able to do that. There's very little I don't like about it. The hard truth of film journalism is the fact that you don't really get to spend much time watching films during your day job. You tend to watch films outside of work hours, because you have writing and editing and spreadsheeting and all these various things, transcribing, all these various things that you have to do during the day, and that's the work bit. and everything else is the fun bit that I do this job for.
So you're busting that myth that we don't just sit here watching films all day, popcorn, drinking Coke.
Can you imagine? We wouldn't have a magazine at the end of every month.
No,
we'd
have nothing to show for it, but we'd have had a really good time.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on to your final choice then. You're closing out this program with...
Donnie Darko.
I met a new friend.
Real or imaginary?
You're a cop, Donnie.
Imaginary.
I'm going to tell you a little story today about a young man whose life was completely destroyed by these instruments of fear.
I haven't seen stuff.
Donnie is experiencing what is commonly called a daylight hallucination.
I have to obey him. He saved my life.
Have you ever seen a portal?
Has he ever told you about his friend Frank, the giant bunny rabbit?
The what?
Look, every living thing follows along set path. And if you could see your path or channel, then you could see into the future, right?
So this is Donnie Darko. Why this one? And when did you see this? And did it blow your mind? And did you even understand it the first time?
I didn't understand a single thing in it, I don't think, but it definitely did blow my mind. So I first saw it in, I think it came out in 2002 in the UK. It came out in 2001 in America. It was a really long wait, which factored into my insane anticipation for this film, because I believe it premiered at Sundance in January 2001, and then came out in America in October 2001. So by that point, reviews were everywhere. Sort of critics all over the world had seen it by that point. The critics were less kind in America, but in the UK, people loved it, and Total Film loved it in particular. And I remember just being insanely hyped for it. It just sounded right up my street. Big science fiction fan, big mystery film fan, loved the imagery of Frank the Bunny, loved time travel. I just loved everything that I was hearing about it. And then when I eventually did see it, absolutely blew me away. One of those films where you just don't know what to make of it at all when you've seen it, because it's so confusing. It's almost overwhelming. Like, I had no idea to process what I'd just seen. On subsequent viewings, I've kind of unpicked it and I've read various things. So I feel like I know it quite well now. But at the time, I was very unsure of what my thoughts were. I just knew deep down that it had really affected me. And I would have been 16 when I first saw it. I guess I would describe myself as quite an emo kid at that time. I was the stereotypical Nirvana-obsessed teenager at that point. And Donnie Darko is just one of the most emo films ever made. So it just spoke to me on a deep level in that way. And the whole process of trying to understand what the film was about, what the wormholes were, learning all the terminology surrounding it, or Roberta Sparrow's book, reading various pages from that. I'm not sure I've ever had that experience with a film before or since where I was just completely obsessed with the mythology surrounding this film in a way that there was a time when I could just explain everything to you in a way that people now go, this is it. I know everything about Middle Earth, or I know everything about Westeros.
So just a total nerd. That's okay.
I was just leaning into it. I was a total nerd for it, basically. And then on top of that, it introduced me to so many great bands, so much great music. Echo and the Bunny Men, Tears for Fears, all this music I just had no awareness of. And I just loved it all. I remember listening to that soundtrack just on hard rotation, just being completely obsessed with it, and then being mildly irked when Richard Kelly changed things in the director's cut and moved the songs about. I was like, that does not go there.
Yeah.
This is not
That's
right.
That's not how I've listened to it.
I mean, we've already spoken a little bit about director's cut, but Donnie Darko is the one where you just don't watch the director's cut. You stick with the theatrical version. That was a film that benefited from its limitations, I think, in not over-explaining things. If I'd have watched the director's cut first, I wouldn't have had that experience where I was trying to piece things together in my head, an experience which completely enriched my understanding and loving of that story. Today, it would be completely different. If Donnie Darko came out today, you would have 20 explainers on the internet the day it came out, which everyone would go to, and they would go, okay, that's what happened. I'm going to move on with my life. That was just a different time. The internet was around, but I think broadband we didn't even have broadband at that point. We still had dial-up, so it wasn't even like I was really online that much. I just had to sort of work it all out myself, and it almost became a part of my identity that I understood what was going on in Donnie Darko, because people at school would just ask me like about Donnie Darko, and I would explain things to them. It was very, very bizarre. Yeah, I became a sort of weird authority on Donnie Darko sensei of school. Exactly. Yeah. So yeah, I've a very real fondness for Donnie Darko, and you know, it's a great film as well. Introduction of Jake Gyllenhaal to my cinematic life, one of my great acting loves. And Richard Kelly sadly has not gone on to do anything quite as great as Donnie Darko, but God, what a debut film.
Yeah, so astonishing. Assured. Yeah. And so are puzzle box films something you like something that challenges you mentally, emotionally, psychologically?
Yeah, they're the things that I really take away from films, I think, because, you know, I watch so many films, so much TV. You start to see the patterns, you start to see familiar storytelling choices, you sort of know where things are going. When there are mysteries and elusive elements, those are the bits that I really latch onto, where I'm like, what did this mean? What did that mean? They're the things that I really want to talk about with people. Like, what do you think this meant? What do you think that thing meant? I think it's really important for filmmakers to, where appropriate, not explain too much, because they're the things that fuel debate, they're the things that fuel interpretation. Not all films need to be completely clear and concise about what their meaning and purpose is. Like, I like films that have their open-endedness.
But on that level, what's your guilty pleasure? There must be a really stupid film with all the answers that you actually do love.
I don't know if I'd really call it a guilty pleasure, but I really love The Crow, the Alex Proyas film, which, you know, I'm not out here saying it's one of the great films ever made, but it's one of the great revenge movies for me. Like, I love that. I used to have the poster above my bed as a teenager. It came to uni with me, went above my bed in uni, which a lot of people thought was very weird. Also on my bedroom wall, in terms of posters, I had Akira, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, one of Jamie's favorites, and Fight Club was another one.
Yeah, this is sending out some weird messages to anyone visiting your room, right?
And Blade 2 and Taxi Driver. Those were all the posters I had. Partly because I loved the poster design, but also because they spoke to emo me at that age. Yeah, I imagine my room wasn't a very welcoming place if you just walked in.
Yeah.
In terms of guilty pleasures, I don't know. I don't entirely agree with the principle of guilty pleasures, just because if you like something, you like it. Like, I don't think you really need to feel guilty about it.
Yeah, it introduces an element of snobbism, doesn't it? That there are right films and wrong films.
Exactly. I think you can, if you enjoy something, you enjoy it. You don't have to feel bad about it.
So on that level, let's ask about treats at the cinema and what you do enjoy. Are you a popcorn person, a sweet or salty, or not a popcorn and something else?
Sweet all the way for me. I'll happily eat like a mix. And if I'm really in a savory mood, I will go for salty. But first choice is pretty much always sweet. When I was younger, I was obsessed with Toffee Butterkiss.
It's great for your teeth, that.
Other toffee popcorns are available, but Toffee Butterkiss was my brand of choice. But yeah, I just can't imagine eating it now. Like, imagine having that much hard toffee in your mouth at any one time.
You'd need to floss in the toilets afterwards.
Yeah, I'd be worried about my teeth getting yanked out, basically. Like, I don't think my mouth could handle it anymore. But sweet popcorn, much, much more gentle on the old gnashers.
Yes. And trailers or no trailers? Are you someone that gets to the cinema to see the whole shebang, or do you like to slip in just as it goes dark?
Definitely trailers. No adverts. Adverts do my nut, as they say. I have a sort of mixed relationship with trailers, in the sense that I don't like a lot of modern trailers that spoil too much. I find myself increasingly avoiding trailers where possible, especially for things I'm very excited about that I know I'm not going to be covering. But when you're in cinema, you obviously can't avoid them. So I have actually had a few experiences recently where I've gone to the cinema and I've seen a trailer for something for the first time because I've just intentionally avoided it online, which was actually an awesome experience. Like, just seeing a trailer for the first time in the cinema is really, really cool, as opposed to seeing it on your laptop screen or whatever, where you can just freeze frame things and pore over it. That was always incredible to me. And I always used to get a real thrill when they would very rarely put on big trailer launches at cinemas for journalists. They did it for The Force Awakens. They did it for Blade Runner 2049. They did it for Avatar, The Way of Water, things like that. And I would just sit agog at it, because it was your first glimpse of it and you were seeing it in the environment it was meant to be seen in. So I would say definitely trailers on the big screen, less so on the small screen. Although, you know, if they drop the trailer for...
We have to watch it. Yeah,
exactly. I'm not going to...
I'll be standing over you asking why you haven't.
Yeah, exactly. Black Panther Wakanda Forever new trailer dropped very recently as we're recording. I was there the second it dropped.
Click, click, click.
Exactly.
Play. This is also an interesting thing. Like, is this program to you? I suspect I know the answer to this, but is it just the last time you're going to be able to go to the cinema because cinema has died? Is it because you're dying? Or is it because the world is ending? It tells a lot about people, how they envisage this.
Oh gosh, I hadn't really thought about that question. I guess I was planning it as a kind of world-ending thing because all of my films have either some kind of nihilistic or apocalyptic theme or undertone or overtone or direct storytelling choice to them. So I was very much thinking the world is ending around us. Let's watch some apocalyptic films, essentially. A couple of good endings, a couple of bad endings, one bit of sweet ending. I think it's a good way to send people out. I know people in the past have sort of thought about the rhythm of their choices and, you know, it not being too much of a downer. But I'm just like, let's just go for it. It's the end of the world. Yeah.
Really down.
Come on.
Let's get really down. And so basically, as the screen's burning then and everything's going to absolute hell, what is the soundtrack you'll be playing?
I find it very hard not to pick a soundtrack from one of my four films because I think they also contain probably four of my favorite film soundtracks as well. The music that I always associate with film credits is the end title sequence music from Blade Runner. Just that propulsive Vangelis. Just so awesome. It's just the best bit of music that they've ever put on film credits. So I'm just going to go with that just because I just don't think you can get any better. And I think even though we've had a very dark, intense evening at the cinema watching these four films, I think that's going to send you off on a bit of a high because you can't help but like tap your toes and like punch the arm of your chair because it's just, oh, it's so awesome.
So that is Jordan's last picture show. He will be putting on Aliens, Blade Runner, The Thing, and Donnie Darko. Thank you for, you know, making us all depressed.
Yeah, you're welcome.
And we'll see who's in the projection booth next time.
That was the Last Picture Show podcast from Total Film. Let us know what four films you'd watch at the end of the world. You can tweet us on @TotalFilm or connect with us on Facebook or our Instagram page.